Dear beloved on-demand listener, while listening to interviews during Issues Etc. 24, you'll hear appeals to join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. We want you to join. However, the phone number for you to join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club while you're listening on demand is 618-223-8385. 618-223-8385. Just disregard the 877 number given out during the broadcast. You can also join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club online, issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening.
Issues Etc. 24, Hour 9, starts now.
We're going to shake your tambourine
at midnight, at midnight,
after midnight. So go be peaches and cream.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. 24, heading into the Book of Job as midnight comes around. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller will be our guest, Pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado. Job is a puzzling book. I remember distinctly, this was during my teenage years, when we started studying the Bible in earnest. It was kind of late high school, typical youth group Bible study, a lot of pooled ignorance and not so bright ideas. And we were talking about Job, and it really does present a serious problem. I mean, what do you do with a book where God allows Satan to take everything away from him? And then, although he does restore to Job all of his fortunes and the things that Satan had taken away, he never explains why. He leaves the question of why completely and utterly unanswered. In fact, to Job's inquiry, God responds only, "Who are you to ask me such a question?" And he rebukes Job for his insolence. So what do you do with it? I remember one of the brighter minds in the Bible study saying, well, there's got to be something that Job did. Job's sin was this or is that. There's a long debate about what Job's sin must have been to have deserved all this. Well, none of us had obviously read the book of Job, at least the part where that very explanation is offered by Job's friends and later refuted by God himself. So, what is the book really all about? It's Thursday, April the 15th, and we're starting 2-hour block of the study of the book of Job here on Issues Etc. 24. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller joins us. You can as well. 1-877-623-MY-IE. 877-623-6943. Yes, we are audacious enough to think that someone would call us after midnight. Talk back at issuesetc.org or Twitter us at issuesetc. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller is a regular guest. He's pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado. Brian, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Todd.
When you were an evangelical, which one of Job's friends were you?
Oh, that's a great... all your questions to me, Todd. Start with that one. When you were an evangelical, you have an obsession with that, you know. We're going to have to work on that. I think I was going to, in thinking of a game for Table Talk Radio, that would be something like this. It was going to be... Eliphaz, Bildad, or Zophar, and you have a quote from one of Job's friends, and you try to sort out which one it comes from, which one of these guys are talking. But I don't think you can do it. I think that all of these so-called friends of Job are a reflection of the same exact theology. I mean, maybe their personalities are a little bit different, but their theology is in a lot of ways a precise expression of how someone who lives under the law reacts to the to bad things in life. And there's three different reactions, and they come together. And so I think I was like all three. I mean, when you live under the law, you only have so many options, and we talk about this quite a bit. You have the option of pride, or you have the option of despair. And the way that looks when something bad comes into your life, the despair option is to think, I deserve it. I've done something to deserve this. Something in my life is now causing God's justice to be manifest on me. And you see that all through the arguments, especially in the first cycle of arguments, and we can talk about the structure of Job a little bit later. You see that explanation of why this bad stuff is happening to Job. The second option is the pride option, and that is, I got to work my way out of it. If something bad is happening to me, then I must have somehow caused it, so now I have to do something to atone for it. I've got to straighten out my life. I've got to get rid of these besetting sins. I've got to somehow make things right with God so this punishment stops. Or the third option, and this is a really quite interesting option. The third option when something bad is happening to someone who's living under the law, or when someone who's living under the law comes along someone where bad things are happening, there's almost a fear of this wickedness, and so you try to avoid it. You say, oh, it's not that bad. You're making a mountain out of a molehill. Here you are wailing about all of this stuff, but it could be worse. And you see this also in the argument of Job's friends. They're sitting there saying, Job will say things like, look, the Lord is my enemy. He's turned against me. He's shot me full of arrows. I'm being destroyed by the Lord who hates me. And his friends will say, oh, you're being chastised. you're being disciplined. The Lord is trying to straighten you out or teach you something. Well, come on. So the third option is to not let the suffering be the suffering. And as an evangelical, which really means living under the law, you have all three different options there.
Okay. And I think by and large, whether someone is an evangelical, a recovering evangelical, or what, our built-in way of reading this book, unless we carefully read the counsel of Job's friends for what it is, bad advice. I mean, it's not presented there as good advice. It's presented there as bad advice, which must ultimately be rejected. In fact, I mean, the book ends with God saying, you better pray for those three characters because I don't like what they had to say. But our default way of reading it is whether or not the book says so or not, Job must have brought this on himself. Does Job bring any of this? Okay, he's a sinner like the rest of us, okay?
We'll
concede that.
Yeah.
But does Job do anything to trigger these events in his life?
Oh, it's great, isn't it? I mean, the whole book of Job is teaching us that we can answer that question no. But still, we resist it. You know, I mean, it's hardwired into our flesh. Our flesh has this religion of the law, so we've got to think that there's got to be some sort of tit for tat kind of thing, some sort of a retribution in God's actions here. But there's not. This is in a lot of ways, Job functions in the canon of Scripture like the bondage of the will does in our theology. In other words, it says, and Job will say this another time, a number of times. He'll say, "Look, God is God, and you can't." I mean, to get any more basic statement of that, but these guys come along with their theology of the law, and they want to lock God into reacting to humanity in some way, and so God is now only going to react to what I do. So if I'm getting good things, it must be God reacting to my goodness, and if I'm getting bad things, it must be God reacting to my badness. Is that God, when He comes to us according to the law, is only reacting to us? And because they have no gospel, the friends of Job, that's all they can say. And now the drill is, the kind of theological task at hand is to somehow justify God and to make excuses for Him. But, I mean, this is great at the end of the book, isn't it? I mean, God Himself shows up, and He doesn't justify Himself. he doesn't even say, you expect when you get to the end of the book, and we really haven't even talked about the beginning, which is maybe the most important part. When you get to the end of the book, you expect God, when he shows up, to say, look, Job, that was the devil doing all this stuff. Not me, it was the devil. But there's no talk like that from God. He apparently is not worried about being justified or about being predictable or about being in any way beholding to our own works. He doesn't need to be, because he's the Redeemer. Maybe we could say it like this. If you don't have the gospel, and in that I mean very specifically, if you don't have God who has handed himself over to our flesh and our sin on the cross, what Job confesses in his great confession in chapter 19 as the Redeemer, if you don't have that, then you have to justify the way that God acts. Apart from the gospel, God has a lot to answer for. But as soon as you sort out, like Job has sorted out from the very beginning, that God is going to hand himself over into our death, then now all of those questions are no longer necessary to be answered for. It's like if a husband is supposed to be home for dinner at 6 o'clock, and he shows up with no explanation, no phone call or anything. He shows up at 9 o'clock at night. He hasn't got a lot to answer for to his wife until he pulls out of his back pocket a new, beautiful pearl necklace. And he says, honey, I'm sorry I was late. I wanted to find just the perfect right gift. And now there's nothing to answer for at all. It's swept away by the joy of the wife having received this gift from the husband. Well, that's how it is with the gospel. As soon as we know that the Lord is handing himself over to our sin and our death on the cross, then now all these questions of divine justice, God answering for the suffering in our life, all of these are cast away.
Okay, let's talk about that heavenly council wherein, wholly apart from consultation with Job, Job's not a part of this in any way. He's kind of like Exhibit A, and that's all the more he is in this heavenly courtroom, where, oddly enough, Satan appears to have some sort of standing. He appears with the other sons of God in God's heavenly courtroom, and they, in a sense, kind of strike a deal about Job. Tell us about it.
Well, there's a couple things there. Maybe let's talk first about the heavenly council, and then about the fact that the devil has a seat in this council. We get a couple of glimpses into this reality in the Old Testament. I mean, we have a few of these places where we see the throne of God and his majesty and all of this there, but that this is a council and that there's arguments going on in this chamber of God, we have a couple of glimpses into. Psalm 2, where you have the contrast of the earthly council, the kings bring themselves together in council, versus the heavenly council, where the Lord sends his Messiah and he laughs. You have it in Zechariah, where you have the high priest standing before the Lord, and that's another place where you have the devil coming along and arguing against the person that presents themselves before God. That's in Zechariah chapter 3, verse 1. You have Jeremiah. This is a marvelous little text in Jeremiah 23, I think, where he says that the false prophets are those that have not stood in the heavenly council. And so the true prophets then, by contrast, are those that have stood in the heavenly council, and they know the things that are declared there. Now, Job knows the voice of the heavenly council, because what does God say of Job? And this is, I mean, chapter 1, verse 8, the Lord says to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? Now, we normally read that like God is describing Job. Like the Lord looks and he says, hey, look, there's Job. He keeps all the commandments or something like this. But this is not what happens in the heavenly council. The heavenly council is where the word of righteousness is applied to sinners. I mean, this is doctrine of justification, where the Lord declares us to be righteous and holy. And so the Lord declares Job to be blameless and to be upright and to be holy. And Job knows that because Job is both the prophet and the king and especially the priest. I mean, when Job is described in chapter 1, remember how it says at the end of this introduction of Job, his sons and daughters would have their feasts, and then in verse 5 it says, when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them. He would rise up early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of all of his children, for he said, it may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. So Job did this continually. So Job knows where righteousness comes from. Not from his own works or his own deeds, but from the sacrifices appointed. From the very beginning, this is how righteousness comes, not by works of the law, but by the atoning sacrifice, by the burnt offerings. So Job knows the voice of the heavenly council, which has declared him righteous. And now, through the whole book, he has to endure the voice of the earthly council, which says to him, Job, you're not righteous. So the devil and his friends set themselves against the heavenly counsel of God to undo Job's faith.
Okay. Satan says, if everything is taken away from him, he will curse you. And God gives him permission to do just about anything he wants. Let's talk about how bad it actually gets for Job, because I think we do tend to, as you said before, kind of fall into the category of one of those advisors of Job who says, come on, it's not that bad. Or it may look bad, but it really, you're making too much of it. How bad does it get for Job under Satan's testing? Ultimately, it's God's testing.
Yeah, well, you have kind of two rounds, we should say it like this. We have three rounds that where Job is going to come, and he's trying to undo, like we said just then, the word of the heavenly council. The devil is all. I mean, this is what the word Satan means, right? The accuser. So he comes to accuse the devil or Job before the Lord, and the Lord won't have it. But now he's going to accuse Job to himself. And the first round is kind of external, touch everything but Job himself. And the drama of it is really quite stunning. Job has all of this stuff. I mean, it lists everything he's got: 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 oxen, 500 female donkeys, very many servants. So the man was the greatest of all the people of the East. And now he's sitting there one day, and it was the day that the children were finishing up their feast. So you have to wonder that if Job was even at this point, when all of these messengers start to come to him, if Job was making sacrifice for his children. I think that's an intriguing possibility. And here comes the messengers. This starts at chapter 1, verse 13. There's a day when the sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, the oxen were plowing, donkeys feeding, and the Sabians fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword. And then in the next verse, while he was yet speaking, so the one servant's coming to tell him that he's lost all of his oxen and his donkeys. And while he's still in the middle of the story, the next servant comes and says, the fire from God fell from heaven and burned up all the sheep and the servants, and I'm alone left to escape to tell you. And while he's still telling that story, then the next servant comes and says, the Chaldeans formed three little raiding groups, and they came and took down, stole all the camels and killed all the servants. And while he's still telling the story, another comes and breaks into the middle of it and says, your sons and daughters were all in the house, and a wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners and fell upon the young people, and they're dead, and I'm all alone left. But this is really quite stunning what Job does. This is chapter 1, verse 20. Job arose, he tears his robe, he shaves his head, he falls on the ground, and the text says, worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.
What in the world? I mean, that's Brian, I mean, granted, the guy had a lot to lose, but he has lost, except, you know, he hasn't yet been touched in his own body, right?
Not yet.
But all your kids are killed in one freak banquet accident, and you've lost the better part of your living in one day, At the very, very least, he's going to have to start over from scratch and without his children, without any heirs whatsoever. And he says, I mean, he's not brushing this off, but he says, blessed be the name of the Lord.
Yeah, I mean, look, these are words of faith that are quite stunning, and this continues throughout the book of Job. He's constantly making these professions of faith. But, you know, there's two texts in Job, at least that I know of and that I remember, that we use in the funeral liturgy. The one is in Job 14, where and this is the first part of the old funeral procession, which says, a man who is born of woman is of few days and full of trouble. I mean, these words echo through my mind because we use them at Hope. We place the pall across the casket in the back of the sanctuary, and then I turn around and kind of go ahead of the procession down the middle aisle, and these are the first words that I speak. He comes out like a flower and withers. He flees like a shadow and continues not. So those are the words of Job that we use in the funeral liturgy. But these first ones that we just spoke, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord, that's also in the funeral liturgy. In fact, those words are appointed to be read right after the reading of the obituary, if you have it, and also in the announcement that comes before the prayer of the day when you announce the death of one of the Lord's saints. I don't normally get too emotionally wrapped up in things unless I'm mostly getting excited about them, but these are some of the most difficult words to speak. When I turn from the altar to the Lord's people before the prayers, and I look at them all in the face, and I say, it has pleased the Lord in his wisdom to take from this veil of tears, to be with himself in heaven, the soul of our brother or the soul of our sister, and I'll tell their name. And you can just see, and the whole congregation, and then to continue. Who died on Thursday, having attained the age of 80 years, 2 months, and 42 days. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. These words from Job can only be spoken by the Spirit, and they're given to us to speak so that we too know that. That when it is for the Christian to receive both good and evil from the hand of the Lord.
Okay, what happens next?
Well, so Job doesn't curse God, so the devil goes back, and then God says, look, the heavenly council again speaks of Job's righteousness, and he says, look, he kept his integrity. He's a blameless and upright man. I've declared it to be so, and look, he is. His faith is still, he's kept his integrity. He still believes in me. He still calls upon my name. And the devil, who hates God and everything that belongs to God, so he absolutely hates Job, says, well, that's because you didn't mess with his body. So the Lord says, all right, just don't kill him. So that the devil goes and afflicts Job with some kind of just absolutely horrendous disease, some sort of boils or something like this. Job says later in the book that his skin dries up and then flakes off, so that he is in such misery that he's there. He's with a clay knife trying to scrape these boils out of his body. And he's sitting on a heap of ashes, weeping. He can't sleep. He's in so much pain. It says when his friends came from afar, they come and they come up to Job and they don't even recognize him. I mean, he is brought down to absolutely nothing. His wife comes then, and this is the kind of the second occasion for Job's confession of faith, chapter 2, where his wife comes and says to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he says to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So that's the story. So here's Job kind of trying to peel out his dying flesh with a piece of broken pot, and he's saying all of this. It's stunning that he says evil comes from the Lord. This is coming from God, but he still trusts in Him. And then his friends come, and they sit there for a week because they saw his affliction and his trouble was so great. But then what happens, and this is really, we said there's three rounds from the devil. So the first round is the devil takes everything that belongs to Job, his possessions, his children, his livelihood. Then the second round is he takes his health, any sort of peace, the ability to eat and sleep and all of this. And then round three comes, which is the worst. I think the worst punishment that comes from the devil are the comforters of Job. These three friends that come to, quote, comfort him and sit with him and speak to him. Because they open their mouth, and now the affliction of Job is not just a physical affliction. Or the affliction of shame. He's now got to endure this spiritual suffering, the temptation of false doctrine to be kind of carried away from his faith in God.
All right, when we come back from this break, we're going to continue on the book of Job. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller is our guest. It's Issues Etc. 24. We've rounded midnight. We are a quarter into this two-hour study of the book of Job with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, and a long way to go, not only in this book, but then after that, more Issues Etc. 24 at 2 o'clock Central Time a.m. Dr. Greg Lockwood will join us. We'll go into the book of 1 Corinthians. We're going to need a book like 1 Corinthians to pep us up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and more books of the Bible to come in Issues Etc. 24, 1-877-623-6943. We'll get to some of your email and your Facebook questions on the book of Job right after this. 1-877-623-6943. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Twitter us at issuesetc. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller is our guest.
LCMS Inc. canceled this? You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Steve Dunham calling from Medford, Oregon. A longtime on-demand listener. Just wanted to call and let you know what Issues Etc. means to me. In my position at the church as an elder and a Sunday school teacher and a choir member, I very often don't get a chance to attend my pastor's Bible study. And my pastor has been blessed with a wonderful gift of teaching, and I miss out that opportunity of being with him for that hour on Sunday mornings often when he's leading a Bible study class. And Issues Etc. fills that gap when I need it and even when I don't need it. And I just want to thank you for your diligent work, all of you, in what you do, and how much, let you know how much I enjoy listening to Issues Etc. and letting my friends know. Thank you once again, and keep up the good work. God bless you.
Well, unlike LCMS Inc., we don't care if you listen live or listen on demand. We're just thankful that you listen, especially those of you listening live right now. It's about 12:32 in the morning Central Time. I'm Jeff Schwartz, producer of Issues Etc., alongside Craig Feichtinger, board operator extraordinaire and director of business operations. We're asking you during Issues Etc. 24 to please consider joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It's our monthly or annually giving program. Four levels of giving: confessor, apologist, reformer, patron. All kinds of benefits of joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, including I Have Issues t-shirts, books, transcripts, getting your church's contact information posted on our website under the Find a Church page. It's the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, the toll-free number that you can call right now and make your donation. Tax-deductible gifts, of course, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943, or you can donate online, issuesetc.org.
We got a call in the last 30 minutes, Jeff, from Pastor Brian Lindemuth from Salt Lake City, Utah. He joined the Reformation Club, so thanks to you, Pastor, for supporting Issues Etc., Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio.
And, of course, Pastor will go into a drawing in about an hour and a half. We'll be drawing, as we do every 2 hours, for an LPR bundle package and an autographed copy of Pastor Matt Harrison's new book, A Little Book on Joy. And then, of course, at the end of Issues Etc. 24, thanks to Concordia Publishing House, 4 leather-bound editions of the Lutheran Study Bible. We'll be drawing for every, put your name in the drawing for everyone who joins the Issues Etc. Reformation Club during Issues Etc. 24. Issuesetc.org or 1-877-623-6943.
Thanks to some current members of the Reformation Club. Thanks to Mr. and Mrs. R. Neely and Martha Owen from Keswick, Virginia. Thanks to Reverend and Mrs. Adrian Corian Piazza from Noblesville, Indiana. Thanks to Charles Rando from Baltimore, Maryland. And William and Elizabeth Crawford from Dallas, Texas.
The Issues Etc. Reformation Club, please consider joining. 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MY-IE or issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. 24. I'm Todd Wilkin. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller is our guest, going through the book of Job. Now, this is the easy part, what we've done so far, just the narrative to begin the book, which is, there's no dispute there. I mean, so far we've got the story as it reads. I want you to note a couple things which are important for understanding this book a little bit later on when we get into the tough stuff, where God just simply refuses to answer most of Job's questions and concerns. And that is, number one, we know what's going on in this story so far. The readers understand who's been doing what role Satan plays, what role God plays, what role Job is playing. Job doesn't know any of this stuff. All he knows is the eternal decree of God made in the heavenly throne room that he is righteous. He is aware that he is a man who is righteous solely by God's declaration, by God's grace. That's what sustains him to this point. That's going to be severely tested. But he doesn't know Satan has struck a deal with God. He doesn't know who's bringing this to him. He assumes it must be God. He doesn't even know Satan is a part of this whole thing. And the biggest thing he doesn't understand or know, even to the end of the book, is why. That question simply does not get answered, although we do know. Job doesn't know why, but he does know who. At least to this point, he still knows who, but he has yet to undergo his third and most terrible test at the hands of Satan. As Pastor Brian Wolfmiller said before the break, the bad advice and the false teaching of his so-called friends. Before we get to that, let's get to some email here, Brian. This one comes from Kelly in Canada. Much of the book is written in a Hebrew poetic form, and that's quite true. What does this mean for how we consider these conversations happening between Job and his friends? Is this to be read as an historical dialogue, or are the discussions stylized somewhat? I mean, it is difficult to stretch his believability a little bit to think that these exact conversations take place in this way. Are they summaries, poetic summaries of what the friends may have said to Job in their time with him?
Yeah, I think what we probably have in the Hebrew is Moses' translation of the Aramaic, which we would presume that was written by Job himself. He, after all, says, you know, this great confession of faith in chapter 19, which hopefully we all heard at Easter time in one way or another. Oh, that I had a pin, that my words were inscribed with an iron pin and a rock forever, for I know that my Redeemer lives. This part. So Job himself, in the middle of this, is saying, hey, I want to write this down. And we know he's a prophet. But it seems like this is maybe there's a lot of Aramaicisms apparently in this in the book. It's very, very difficult Hebrew by all accounts. So that what probably happened is that Job himself, after he's restored to his office of prophet and priest at the end of the book, well, he always has his office, but he's kind of restored to the exercise of that office, that he goes and he writes this down, and he puts the argument of all of the people, the three friends that come against him, Elihu, who comes at the end to rebuke him properly, and even the words that the Lord speaks, that he puts it in a poetic form. And this is a little bit more conjecture, but perhaps when the children of Israel are wandering in the desert, they come across this text from believing Job, and Moses himself then brings it across into Hebrew. So while we can say that the text that we have is stylized, it's that we would understand that it would be a poetic report of the actual historic events. And this is maybe, I've got this growing conviction, Todd, and I'll bounce it off of you, is that as we read this through the scriptures, and I perhaps used to think of the Bible or look at the Bible chiefly as a theological text, but I think that the way the Bible gives itself to us is a historical text. And we learn our theology from the history, but we have a God who deals with us, with real people and real events, and he deals with us according to our name and who we are and all of this sort of thing. So I'm convinced that every part of the Bible, unless it presents itself, of course, differently, but that every part of the Bible is chiefly a historical account, and that we receive Job that way as well. Are you there still?
Yeah, I'm still here. I just my mic just went away. This is the only technical snafu we will permit in 24 hours of broadcasting. Wilkins' mic not up when it should be. This one comes from Darren in Garland, Texas, my home state. He says, being brought up in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, now famous for its great liberal swing, the whole book of Job, and for that matter Jonah, was considered to be a fable of some kind, an Old Testament parable. What do you think? Asks Darren.
Yeah, again, I think, I mean, the Bible does not present itself to us as a book of moral stories. In fact, if Job was a kind of some sort of epic poem to explain the way that God does things, it is an utter failure at that. Because as you've pointed out any number of times, God is just not explained in the end. He's not. I think that our natural inclination as we go through the Bible from Genesis all the way to Revelation is to read these texts as history. I mean, even if when we say something in the creed like this, that Jesus suffered under Pontius Pilate, and that's going to inform the way we read the scriptures, because God is acting in a location, with a place. I mean, it says here's this man, Job, who lives in the land of Uz, and he talks about, and this is some amazing sort of thing. He says, who's going to go find wisdom? He says, this is later in the book when Job is arguing. He says, the man goes out into the sticks, and he goes down and he digs a hole and he pulls the ore and the gold out of the earth. So he's talking about this mining and all of these things that are real and going on in the world around him. I think that because of all of these things, both internal and external evidence, and even just theologically, that we receive these books as accounts of real things that happen to real people. That's what the Lord is not interested in making things up. He deals with reality.
Okay, John in Belleville, Illinois, nearby, says, Pastor Wolfmiller just spoke a little on God saying, consider my servant Job, who is blameless, etc. And the pastor commented on the sacrifices. My question, is Job's righteousness in God's eyes due to his great faith in the past, his great faith in the midst of trial, this following of the law and atoning sacrifices, or the righteousness of Christ, which he has by faith, who will come in time, or a combination of these? That's his first question.
Yeah, that's good. The first thing to say with that question is, and this is just a slight thing, but the question mentioned a number of times the great faith of Job, and it's true. Job does have great faith, but the justification that the Lord, the faith that the Lord accounts as righteous when He justifies us, is not great faith. It's just faith. I mean, Jesus will say, even if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you know, you say to the mountain, go over here, and it falls into the ocean. So that if Job had great faith, or if he had weak faith, or if he had just tiny little mustard seed faith, that doesn't matter. But then to get to the meat of the question, I think the answer is not a combination of all of these things, sacrifices, faith in the coming Redeemer, all of his righteous works, etc., but to see this as a precise unity. I mean, the sacrifices in the Old Testament, you just had Genesis, and I was listening a little bit, and you had this at the very beginning, you had the first promise of the gospel in Genesis 3, and then right after the Lord gives this promise that he's going to send a seed to the woman, this man born of a virgin, or born of a woman without any help of a man, who's going to be crushed by the devil, but in the process he's going to destroy the devil and bring life back to humanity and all creation. This promise is then accompanied by the sacrifice where the Lord goes and takes an animal and kills it, apparently, to get the skin to cover the shame of Adam and Eve. So that the practice of sacrifice from the beginning in the garden all the way through to the death of Jesus, the sacrifice is always a preaching of the gospel, of the death of the Messiah in our place. So every time, so Job is before the establishment of the tabernacle under Moses. So back in the patriarchal period where the fathers of the families were also the priests. But every time that the priests there, the fathers, are offering an animal on the altar, the preaching that goes along with it is this. Look, the Lord should be killing you because of your sin, but he's accepting in your place the death of another because he has promised himself as the sacrifice. He has promised himself, and until that sacrifice comes, he is receiving this blood as a covering for my sinfulness. So the theology of the sacrifice is not a theology of works, but it goes along with the preaching of the word, the death of the Messiah. And this is how we must understand all of the sacrifices in the Old Testament this way. I mean, the way the pagans offer sacrifices is to say that God is hungry and he needs something to eat, or that God is fickle and he needs now us to somehow be his servants, or that God is poor and he needs us to give him something so that he can be rich. In other words, it's somehow I am giving something to God to manipulate the way he's going to act towards me. But the theology for the Lord's people is precisely the opposite. The Lord is providing another to stand in my place under his wrath so that he can call me holy and righteous and blameless and upright and holy. Oh, he said that one in his sight. So that the sacrifices are precisely God's gifts to us. He says, I mean, this is the preaching of the prophets. Look, I abhor your sacrifices. He says, well, how can God abhor the very thing that he commanded? Well, he abhors the sacrifices of the people because they think that in offering these sacrifices, they're somehow getting God to act how they want him to act, so that rather than receiving the sacrifices as God's gifts, they are turning them into their own works, which is the exact opposite of why the Lord gave the sacrifices. So the righteousness of Job that's spoken in the heavenly council, Job knows because he has seen the blood shed on the altar, and he knows what that means. He knows it means that his Redeemer is going to stand on the earth. He's going to die, and he's going to rise for him. And because of that, Job is declared holy in the eyes of God.
Okay, now you just answered the emailer's second question. He has a third, and he says, in the verses that say, I know that my Redeemer lives, is Job thinking of Christ specifically, or speaking of God, Yahweh, the Trinity, as his Redeemer? This is kind of the perennial question about the Old Testament saints who we know anticipate the coming of the Christ. Are they thinking in those terms specifically?
I think so. I think one of our temptations nowadays is to read the Old Testament, especially like the Sadducees did, so that the Sadducees didn't go for the resurrection. And I remember taking a Bible as lit class in college where, I mean, this is just accepted knowledge among the libs. They say there is no resurrection in the Old Testament. There is no Trinity in the Old Testament. There is no vicarious sacrifice in the Old Testament. There's no divine and human nature in the Messiah in the Old Testament. I mean, this is just, and it's almost given. I think this is utterly and totally wrong. So that the idea of the incarnation is there in Genesis 3:15, when God says that that the seed of the woman will destroy the devil. Now you got a couple of things working there that are just incredible. First of all, the seed of the woman has to be a man; otherwise, it wouldn't be the seed of a woman. It's going to be a child. It's going to be a baby. That's why when in Revelation 12, when God gives to John the vision of Israel, it's a pregnant woman, because the entire Old Testament was just like people waiting outside of the birthing room for the baby to be born. Every time a Jewish woman would have gotten pregnant, she would have thought to herself, "Could this be the Messiah? Could this be the one?" So that the Redeemer is going to be a man, and yet he is going to destroy the devil. This is not something that a mere man can do. I mean, the best Adam and Eve could have done, maybe, would have been to resist the devil, to fight him off. But to destroy the devil, that's outside the realm of possibility for a human. So here, from the very beginning, this promise that God gives to Adam and Eve is that this Redeemer, this Messiah, this one who's coming, will be both God and man together, united in one, and that he will be destroyed. That's what it means to be crushed according to the heel there. So that, this theology of the two natures of Christ and his death, and even his resurrection, which Job confesses, is the gospel from the very beginning. So I'm convinced that Job knew this and confessed it so fantastically clear in this. Really, it's his greatest confession of faith that he makes in Job chapter 19.
Okay, I am convinced that what follows here, by way of our study, these three interminable cycles of arguments from Job's friends, and we'll talk about each one of them in turn, is intended to frustrate the reader as much as it must have frustrated Job or God.
I like that. Yeah, it could be. Well, we want to talk about the structure really quick, because to kind of put it in line, and I think it's helpful to have an outline. The Lutheran Study Bible has a good outline, but really every outline of Job will follow the same sort of. When you get to this middle part, it'll follow the same sort of thing. And what the people that outline it do, and I think this is kind of convenient. Almost everyone does this. They just say first speech, second speech, third speech, but they don't tell you what the speech is about, because it's kind of tough. But what happens is from chapter 3 all the way until chapter 31. You have a series of three speeches from each of Job's three friends. Now the pattern breaks down towards the end, but you have Job's opening argument in chapter 3, and then you have the first cycle of arguments, really, that goes from chapter 4 to 14. Eliphaz argues with Job, then Job responds. Bildad, then Job responds. Zophar, and then Job responds. Then you get a second cycle, chapter 15 to 21, Eliphaz, then Job, Bildad, then Job, Zophar, then Job, again. And then you get to the third cycle, 22 to 31, Eliphaz, and then Job responds, then Bildad, and Job responds. So there's no, in the third cycle, Zophar falls off. He's not, and Bildad is just fuming. He can't stand it. I mean, Job mentions towards the end of the second cycle, he says, look, I want to argue with God, not you guys. I want to argue with God. And these guys, they go berserk. They don't know what to say about that. Which is really quite something. Job makes his closing arguments in chapter 27 to 31, and it's really when you get to chapter 31 that things go desperately wrong in Job's mind. So a fourth character comes in, Elihu, who's a young buck, and he makes four arguments with Job. That's chapter 32 to 37. And then the Lord comes now, and he's going to speak. He's going to argue with Job himself. And so he argues with Job, his first argument, chapter 38 to 40, verse 2, then Job responds. And then the Lord makes a second argument with Job, and then Job responds. So that's kind of the quick overview of the outline, the way that the kind of the poetry unfolds. And there's a difficulty here, too. I mean, maybe even in just the way we think about it, because most of the time when we read the scriptures, we're asking ourselves, what's right about this? And in other words, we know what the prophets are saying or what the apostles are saying is true, and we're trying to sort out how what we think is wrong according to what the scriptures are telling us. But when we read Job, we really have to do the opposite. We're not asking, what is this teaching me that's true? In fact, when we read through these arguments, we're asking the question, where is this going wrong? What's off about these arguments? So we got to come at these we got to come at the guts of Job from the opposite angle that we normally come at the scriptures.
Well, that would also seem to suggest that it's very dangerous to simply pick out a verse of Job out of its context and quote it as though it can be quoted in the same way that the true teaching of, say, St. Paul is quoted. You can pick any verse in Romans and unless you completely light it from its context, like there is no God or something like that, you will have, without a terribly large amount of context, the truth. Not so with this. You can't just put your finger down on any verse in Job and say you're going to get a true statement.
Right, that's right. In fact, that's the great thing, because a lot of these arguments that these guys are making, they sound pretty good. And you're tracking along, and you're thinking to yourself, oh, yeah, he's got it. Now he's got his finger on things. He's going to correct Job. Job's going to have to repent. And then Job comes along afterwards, and he says, I could talk like that, too, if I was interested in making wind. You know? Or, boy, you guys are miserable counselors. You're just heaping death upon me or something. You're like, oh, well, maybe that wasn't so good. But then you're tracking along, and you think, oh, Job's doing all right. He's holding his own. He's making it through. But then at the end, it starts to fall apart there, and you say, well, where can I see the seeds of Job's kind of false doctrine? Can I see it in the previous things? It is tricky and a little bit subtle to go through these things, and that's why I like what you said, that as we get wrapped up in this thing, we start to get confused too. Which is right? Which is wrong? Is Job right or is Job wrong? I mean, one time one of Job's friends will say something, we're like, nah, that can't be true. And then Job will come along and he says, yes, I know that's true, but what about this? And, oh, it got me again. And so we're being shown the confusing voice of the earthly council. I mean, I want to see this whole book like this. And this is, I owe a great debt of insight to my friend and pastor, Warren Graff, down in Grace Lutheran Church in Albuquerque, for showing this to me, is that what you have in the book of Job is the contrast between the words spoken of us in the heavenly council versus the words spoken to us in the earthly council. And the book of Job is training us to listen to the clarity of the heavenly council. It doesn't take 40 chapters for the heavenly council to speak. It just takes one. It just takes a couple of verses. Blameless, upright, fears God. Pow, done. The earthly council goes on and on and on. All these platitudes and windy speeches and all these cliches and all this other stuff. But the voice of the heavenly council has this kind of marvelous simplicity as opposed to the confusion of this earthly council.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that that kind of good way of understanding Job comes from Pastor Graff. He's, as far as I know, the only pastor who has a mustache to rival that of Pastor Matt Harrison's. I think he might even exceed Pastor Harrison in the mustache department, which is really saying something. So thank him on my behalf for that insight.
I will.
All right. Oh, I should say, by the way, that our guest, Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, made a feeble stab at a Harrison mustache earlier during Lent, and then in great shame had to shave it all off. I saw him do that on Facebook, and he's probably better.
I'm supposed to be live blogging on Facebook right now. I forgot. I got into it here. I'll go back to my...
Well, we pay attention to your work here. We've only got you for another hour. But when we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller on the book of Job. Yes, one more hour of the book of Job. We're devoting 2 hours to each of the books of the Bible here during Issues Etc. 24. No idea what hour we're in. I just know it's almost 1 o'clock in the morning here Central Time. And one more hour of the book of Job. Then, after Job, what are we doing? 1 Corinthians with Dr. Greg Lockwood. We're going to have to go all the way to Australia and then someplace overseas with Dr. Bill Weinrich to do John, back to Australia with Dr. John Kleinig to do Leviticus. And that's still 4 hours short of Issues Etc. 24. It's Thursday, April the 15th, very early in the morning. We're doing 24 hours of continuous live broadcast. Nothing's pre-recorded. Someone IM'd me earlier this evening saying, are you going to have any guest hosts? I haven't seen any come in yet tonight. Yeah, it's Josh Rader's out there waving his arms. Fat chance, Josh. I'll stay here as long as I can. If I keel over, we might let you have a word or two at the mic. So when we come back, more Issues Etc. 24 with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, the Book of Job.
Lutheran Radio in Exile, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for the programming that you provide. I am Cindy from Milton, Florida. Just wanted to let you know that I listen to Issues because the bottom line is you guys are the greatest Christian program out there. You provide great topics, a great sense of humor, and just love listening to you and hearing the gospel that you proclaim every day on Christ crucified. Thank you again. Blessings. Bye.
Well, thank you for listening, and if you share her sentiments that it's the greatest radio program in Christian radio, please consider joining our monthly or annual giving program, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. You can pledge your support right now, 877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-IE, or make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can find out all the benefits of joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club right there at our homepage. Look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. You'll find all the different levels and all the different benefits at those different levels, whether it be the confessor, the apologist, the reformer, or the patron. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club, 877-623-MY-IE. Or issuesetc.org.
Hey, Jeff, we've had someone call and join the Reformation Club in the last half hour. That's Darren Lathan. He's from Garland, Texas. So thank you, Darren, for supporting Issues Etc., Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio.
Thanks so much, Darren, and thanks for everybody who's staying with us through the night. We still have quite a few hours left in Issues Etc. 24. And my tongue is tied. I know a little bit more. And I was just telling Pastor Scott Clems out in California, was talking to him, and I told him I've got to just keep reminding myself to talk slower because it's the combination of the fatigue with the caffeine makes you very tongue-tied.
I think you need to just hold your nose and just drink the coffee.
Not going to happen.
You'll be all right. And with some jump rope rope added in there, Jeff, we're going to make it. Hey, a quick thank you to some folks who are members of the Reformation Club. Mr. and Mrs. Randy and Jerry Reynoldson from Fort Worth, Texas. Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. David and Barbara Buncey from San Jose, California. Sonia Ringen from Longmont, Colorado, and Rich Vanette from Savage, Minnesota. Thank you very much for supporting Issues Etc., Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio.
Josh posts on Facebook, I'm up with you guys for the night. I'm at work and listening now. It's great to have others working at this time of night. Thanks for doing this, guys, and thank you, Josh, for listening. We've got a little shot of adrenaline here, some guests here in studio, Bill Ford from Brookfield, Illinois, and Josh Schrader, a seminarian at Concordia Seminary St. Louis, so it's always nice to have visitors. Feel free to stop by anytime during Issues Etc. 24, 1600 Golfview Drive, Suite 230 here in Collinsville, Illinois. love to have you stop by. And thanks to everyone who's pledged so far to join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. We couldn't do this worldwide outreach without your support. 1-877-623-6943 or issuesetc.org.
Yes, thanks to everyone who's pledged so far, and we look forward to talking with you about the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. There are four levels. The Confessor, that's a one-time yearly donation of $250 or $25 a month. The Apologist is $500 yearly or $50 a month. The Reformer, $1,000 yearly or $100 a month. And the Patron, $2,000 yearly or $200 a month. And each one of those levels of giving to Issues Etc. comes along with a T-shirt, some books, Issues Etc. books of the month. Your church gets a benefit out of that as well if you're a Reformer or a Patron, and a transcript of the broadcast.
Hey, Todd, Gary in Honolulu, Hawaii. I wonder what time is it in Honolulu right now.
Oh, who knows?
I think they're 5 hours behind.
5 hours behind us?
Yeah.
Well, he writes, did you guys get any coffee advice from Pastor Paul McCain of Concordia Publishing House prior to the show? Do you know what he's talking about?
I have no idea.
Neither do I.
I didn't get any email or anything.
Obviously,
like that.
We are not coffee aficionados, are we? I mean, we had the bun thing. You and I didn't know what bun meant, and we're kind of out of the loop on this issue.
Well, I mean, if we get advice for coffee, it's not going to do us much good as long as the water is as bad as it is. But if somebody wants to bring us some coffee, we'll be happy to take some real coffee. If somebody wants to bring us some by, I mean, even Pastor Paul McCain, if he'd be so kind as to drive us over some coffee, we'd be happy about that.
You know, Cafe Mocha from Panera Bread or AKA St. Louis Bread Company, that's my...
Is that
favorite.
Your preferred?
That's my preferred.
That's your preferred brew.
Yes.
I thought it wasn't coffee you got there. I thought it was some cafe mocha latte thing. What is it?
Cafe mocha. Yeah, it's cafe mocha. It's kind of like the Wilcochino. I think they stole it from you. They just don't call it the Wilcochino.
But see, the Wilcochino is just, it's a strip. Wilcochino is stripped down. There's nothing fancy about it. There's no foaming. There's no steaming. There's no frapping. There's no... what is it, the little ice crystals that you have in yours, and there's no whipped cream, no chocolate syrup. It's just regular old black coffee, Swiss Miss, chocolate mix. Mix it together. That's the Wilcochino. It's kind of, well, Jeff, it's kind of like the man's version of what you usually drink.
Okay,
so.
But are you talking about my warm drink, my Cafe Mocha from St. Louis Bread Company, or my QT frozen cappuccino?
Either one.
You know what? The Wilcochino's sounding pretty good right now, Craig.
Can't you see Todd with a chilada in one hand, a Wilcochino in the other, and he's wearing his manprees?
That's true.
You know what?
It's a whole ensemble.
Even the Wilcochino might not taste very good with Collinsville's water.
Well, you know, that's how I first developed the Wilcochino. Did you know that?
Oh, taste?
No, necessity is the mother of invention, and the invention of the Wilcochino came... through the fact that the first time I tasted coffee made with Collinsville water, I'm like, this is not going to do. So I was casting about. I didn't want to do like Jeff does, which is put about 10 cubes of sugar in there with all sorts of that creamer that's got to be a major source of cancer or something. So I thought, why not just a little bit of the cocoa that Craig keeps around? And it was great. It turned out great. And it did mask the flavor. I mean, it took a lot. But it did mask the flavor. So it's probably the same reason why chilada was invented, to mask the flavor of whatever. I don't know, maybe the Clamato masks the flavor of the beer or the other way around. Who knows? Necessity, the mother of invention.
All right. Whether you're listening live or on demand, we'd love for you to please consider joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Pledge your support, 1-877-623-6943. Or online at issuesetc.org. Stay up with us. More Issues Etc. 24. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for your support.